What have you heard? And why did you listen?
Well, sir, I heard a deal that I didn't rightly understand about an enemy and rings and about elves, sir. Oh, I would dearly love to see elves, Mr. Frodo.
And so you shall, Sam. So you shall.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the IMMP, the Intermillennium Media Project podcast. My name is Matthew Porter.
And I'm the poorly sketched copy of Ian Porter.
I'm his dad. He's my son. And I've made him watch a movie, a feature film.
Was that what this was?
A feature film that I saw in its first week of release back in 1978.
Oh, Dad, why am I both excited and sad for you?
Well, last episode, when we talked about The Hobbit, specifically the 1977 Rankin-Bass adaptation of The Hobbit for TV, I mentioned the fact that Tolkien and The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings were pretty darn important to me right around that time.
Yeah.
So I was really excited when word came out that an animated adaptation of The Lord of the Rings was going to be released.
I can understand why. That sounds awesome.
And it was going to be released, it was going to be made by a guy named Ralph Bakshi, none of whose work I had seen before then. But I understood and had read about the fact that he was supposed to be this amazing, innovative, artistic animation filmmaker. And I've seen a lot of his stuff since then, and I wouldn't dispute any of those things I just said. But this was going to be the first Bakshi movie that I got to see, and it was an adaptation of The Lord of the Rings. How cool is that?
It's kind of wild because in some ways, when you told me about this, I knew what was coming because it had a hype to it for me as well, but not in the direction you're pointing.
What kind of hype did it have for you?
You see, I have grown up in the internet era and I've seen and watched the rise and fall of various types of online media discussion. Online criticism, online discussion boards and such that would break down and look up an old weird movies. And so Ralph Bakshi, with things like Cool World and Wizards and Fritz the Cat, has a reputation, a very different reputation in those circles, as being weird, wild stuff you're gonna see. It's like, hold on, this is a roller coaster. And so knowing he'd done a version of Lord of the Rings, I was all prepared for, this is going to be weird. And it was.
Now, when I was 12 years old or so, I had not seen Fritz the Cat, which is what Bakshi was most known for. I still haven't. I've seen Wizards since then. Haven't seen Cool World. I've seen American Pop, which is an amazing movie. And some of these are movies that I should make sure that you get to see. But yeah, I can see where, in the context of all of Bakshi's work, this has a different feel, especially if you're looking back at it.
Yeah, it becomes part of a narrative through line about a creator's style and body of work instead of an individual piece in that sense. But coming from it from the view of, I'm interested in the thing this is adapting, I can really understand getting hyped.
I was thrilled about it being an adaptation of something I was so excited about, but also everything I had heard about the way it was made and about this is an animated feature, but not a kid's movie. Mm-hmm. A lot of things that at the time were amazing and new and innovative to me. And to address this right away, Bakshi's known as an animator, an animation filmmaker, and this is an animated adaptation of The Lord of the Rings. But is it really an animated movie?
No, this is a fever dream adaptation of 2/3 of The Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, and it's also... it's... some of it's animated. Even at the time, I knew what rotoscoping was, and rotoscoping is an absolutely valid tool in animation, and rotoscoped things are still animated. Oh, and rotoscoping had been used all the way back to Walt Disney's earliest movies. So Bakshi really liked rotoscoping, and he uses that in a lot of his movies, uses it to really strong effect in, for example, American Pop, which I think is great. And rotoscoping, that's you take live action footage and use the frames of that live action film as the basis, usually often with just tracing kind of techniques, to turn the live action film into drawn animation.
There's a variety of things that people can do and you see happen in your day-to-day life that are just movements that are hard to draw without reference in that sense because of angles, perspective, human body, object in the environment, moving shots. It's something that's still used a lot today in various things just because it captures that bit that would take forever otherwise by kind of giving us that actually how it would happen and then letting us draw around it.
And you look at the some of the early Walt Disney features, some like the dancing scenes, and I think it's Cinderella. It's so fluid and smooth because it relies heavily on rotoscoping, and they shot really talented dancers and used that as the basis for their animation.
Yeah, then once they can get that frame and know how it's going to move, they can draw the rest of the scene around it and into it as they need.
But this, there's a lot of barely touched live action footage in this movie.
It's the difference between rotoscoping being used in two very different ways there. There's rotoscoping the tool and rotoscoping the product. And rotoscoping the tool is like taking an ingredient, cooking it into something else, using it as part of a recipe, and making a thing. It's like, I've taken these potatoes, I've roasted them and seasoned them and chopped them up and served them to you. And then there's rotoscoping the product, which is just throwing a potato on a plate and saying, here. And I'm here... I'm just imagining young you ready to see this in the theater, sitting down and being excited and coming at this and seeing the way Frodo rotoscoping from still frame to still frame, his eyes change size and his limbs distort and going, ah! And I feel the same thing, because I'm here even prepared for this is going to be Bakshi weirdness on something I happen to know. And I see that same thing, and I go, ah! Everyone is Gollum. Everyone is Gollum in this movie.
Yeah, there are a couple of different things going on. One is there's some of the animation, some of the character designs. It's 90% of the time, at least. These particular characters are fully hand-drawn animation, like Frodo and the other hobbits, and most of the other members of the Fellowship, and Gandalf. And yet, the drawing, you're right, it's the features swimming around on a person's face because they're moving around from one frame to the next. And then there are other characters who they're just throwing tinted live-action footage into the frame.
The wildest thing for me is the way the tint highlights things, where it's like, okay, we're in the giant fight of armies against each other, and how can you tell who is who? If they have a defined face, they're a Fellowship member. If they have a weirdly defined abdominal muscles, they're a fighter, because everyone's this like gym guy that they've got to put on light armor on their shoulder pads. And the filter just blanks out half their facial features, but you can see all of the things highlighted by the shadows on their oil.
And none of the fighters wear pants, apparently.
Yeah.
Even our Fellowship members, Boromir and Aragorn, are wearing long tunics that about come to their knees, and they don't seem to be wearing anything under them.
No true rotoscoped Scotsman going on here.
And I've talked about the value and the effect of putting different kinds of film quality, different kinds of animation quality together into the same movie, and how that can really work when we're talking, for example, when we've talked about Ray Harryhausen's stop motion. When we talked a bit about the weird composite and collage effects used in Ken Russell's Altered States.
I can pull an example from my own stuff. It's in the movie we haven't watched yet, but it's a great one, which is Disney's Atlantis, where it's classic Disney animation. But all of the magical technology, they don't hide their CGI as much. So floating crystals and flying airships look like they're from a different place because they're mixing animation styles.
Right. If you have a baseline world, adding some other technique can make it look otherworldly. The monsters in a Sinbad movie look magical because they look different than the wood of your ship and the sand of your beach. These are weird and different. The strange, bright collage composites in Altered States, that is a drug trip letting you see another dimension. It's different. Like you're saying, the place is having a different technology. They could have done that here in this Lord of the Rings movie. And instead, it just seems to be pretty random and haphazard what gets what technique. And I think it had more to do with budget and tight schedules than about any really clear vision that Bakshi had about how to use these different techniques and why.
Yeah, there's something that feels incomplete about this. And that's not just because they don't finish the story. It's because there are scenes that feel like they were being used for setup. And they were being used for, like, pre-production or, like, mid-production stages where it's like, okay, now we're going to have to go over and give detail to these characters. Oh, wait, we're out of time. Throw the animatic onto the screen alongside the piece we've done. That just messes with you.
And the same character can be portrayed in these vastly different ways by these vastly different technologies, changing from one shot to the next and back again. It's very disorienting. And I'm fine with a movie being disorienting for a purpose. I don't really get the purpose as to why that happens as often as it does in this movie.
There is a scene that almost actually works to show what the otherworldliness could have been. And weirdly enough, it's a scene I think goes absolutely wrong and off the rails, which is Frodo and Sam with Galadriel at the fountain to see things.
Yes, they yes, do. That
they do,
works.
They do brilliant swirling effects in this. And while the hobbits are both done in this dark, heavily inked, high detail kind of style, she's done with this. My mind is defaulting for some reason to Don Bluth VTuber. Like half-formed, high-saturation color palette, slightly stiff movement. And it makes her feel alien to them. The fact that she brushes off the potential end of their world like it's nothing in a weird, I'm joking with you in the line at Starbucks kind of way, I don't know why. I think the scene goes wrong. But animation-wise, you put it on mute, and you almost can get something out of that difference.
And given the material they're working with, these different techniques could have been used so well. If, for example, the mundane world that the hobbits inhabit and that they need to travel through to accomplish their quest, and the men and elves and dwarves that they meet, if all of that was a baseline recognizable animation style, whatever style they picked, and then the Nazgul, or anything that had been touched by the power of Sauron, suddenly that dimension is the thinly rotoscoped, German expressionistic, high contrast kind of vision that we do get. It works best with the Nazgul. then suddenly that would be the contrast. That would be the two worlds that are fighting each other. Those would be the two worlds that Frodo is caught between. Could have been so good. But instead, we get to the inn at Bree, and all of the humans drinking in Bree are like a tinted home movie from a Renaissance festival.
Yeah.
It loses the power that that technique could have had.
They're not just lightly tinted, they're oddly heavily tinted. This is coming up on like splice in clips from Trolls World Tour. The character color tones won't differ too much.
So, yeah, that's the biggest thing that you'll notice watching this movie is the weird juxtaposition of different filmmaking styles. And you know, you can make your own decisions about how well that was used, how well that worked. But you mentioned that this only covers the first half of the story. It gets you to more or less roughly kind of the middle of the Two Towers in terms of the three novels.
you get the Fellowship of the Ring and one tower. You can have the other later.
and even at that, of course, it's kind of rushed. So there are parts of this movie where they take their time and they depict a cool scene, and parts of this movie that, heck, let's get this done. We got to move to the next part. It starts with kind of the background history as a kind of a shadow play. And that's an interesting use of animation, that this high contrast shadow puppetry is history. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's a convention of storytelling that I was in at. I was accepting at the beginning there. And then we go into the story and we start with Bilbo's birthday party, where he's going to say farewell.
And we kind of get a very quick but also odd version of showing how Bilbo is wanting to hold on to the ring. It's a good scene in that sense.
Yeah, and they set up the pieces they need.
We get to meet Frodo, who for some reason always looks like he thinks someone's trying to pull a prank on him.
Very wary, yes.
This is like the most hesitant Frodo. He's just, every still shot I can find, he looks like he doesn't believe the headline he just read. It's like, really?
And we don't see too much of Frodo during the birthday party scene.
No.
They illustrate the birthday party scene and Bilbo's departure. And then it's like, bam, 17 years later.
Yeah.
And Gandalf is coming back to talk to Frodo and talk about the secret of the ring. And there's no build up to that. There's no tension. It's just, we got to find out what this ring is. We got to move fast. We got to get to that. And they do.
They don't even show that there's text on the ring. There's no engravings. There's just, it's not even warm.
Oh, wow. I didn't even catch that.
They skip the poem.
Do they really?
I think they put in like one line and it's not the full thing, so you don't get context.
Oh, wow.
I just remember thinking, wait, they missed a part in that. And they kind of zip along only to get to going outside in the garden where the perspective gets wonkier. And then they introduce the fact that our boy Sam is absolutely ruined in this. They did so bad with him. He's purely a bumbling comic relief character.
He really is. He is very much a kind of a goofball. He's portrayed as being significantly older than Frodo, which may be, you know, accurate to the book, but like generationally older, it seems to me. Really a buffoon character. And when they introduce him, it's this weird scene where Frodo and Gandalf are just walking in the garden and they're talking about this perilous history and the horrible nature of this ring. And as wary as Frodo seems most of the time, it's a very casual conversation. There's no weight to it. Oh, and this is the ring that was supposed to subjugate all sentient beings. Oh, that's interesting. I guess we should do something about that.
Existential crisis.
What do you
think
we should do, Gandalf?
Existential crisis. What do you think we should do, Gandalf? Well, I think we should get this guy out of here. Yoink. It's like, what? Okay.
Now, I think that how you choose to portray Gandalf is very important with any adaptation of Tolkien, because it kind of sets the tone. Gandalf is this creature, is this being, this person who is important to the story right now. and has a knowledge and presence throughout history as well. And in this, my biggest note about Gandalf is he has a lot of rap gestures.
Yes! He's
throwing signs all over the place as in the middle of conversation. And it makes Gandalf seem very fidgety. It makes Gandalf seem a little bit coked up.
Yes!
Very odd.
Weirdly enough, that reference just means that between that and having seen Ghost Dog, Way of the Samurai a couple times, now I just want Wu-Tang Clan to do a live-action version of Lord of the Rings, which could be amazing.
Sign me up. Yes, please.
That would be an amazing thing. But that's a very different kind of, like, just the idea of rap Gandalf kind of leans into something very different here.
Yeah, maybe get Jim Jarmusch to direct it.
Yeah.
Wow. That would be cool.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a little bit of that with Saruman, too. And we see early on, kind of out of place, we see the fight between Gandalf and Saruman. As opposed to it being sort of a flashback, the way it is in the story and most other depictions. That way that they have Gandalf moving, the fact that, in some ways kind of similar to that Rankin-Bass version of The Hobbit, there's all this super tight and cramped line work and squiggly animation, even in the stuff that isn't obviously rotoscoped. Or barely rotoscoped. It's a very nervous-making kind of visual language.
It is, and it can completely undercut certain scenes. Because I mean, they use it even for things. They use it for the Balrog. Talking about Gandalf, they use it for the Balrog later, and he feels like a guy in a suit, animated at half the frames of everyone else. It feels like someone ran out of miniatures for your D&D campaign and put a Funko Pop down as the big bad. There's just something that immediately lessens the tension.
Well, I don't know. I've used a can of soup as the big bad in a battle in a D&D game, and it worked really well.
Was it out of date? Because then it's scary.
If that depiction of the Balrog were distinctly different from anything we had seen before, that would have been amazing. But if it's, they've gone back to the cheap animation technique they used in the inn at Bree.
Yeah.
Yeah, that doesn't have the punch it should.
It doesn't.
And the journey to get to Bree is like this very brief walk in the park. It was another one of these parts where it's like, we don't have time, we'll just get them to Bree. So it's Frodo and Sam walk to Bree from Hobbiton, and a couple of their cousins join them. No big deal. They get there. It makes making it easy, not showing us any difficulty in getting to each of these stages, makes the stages just seem like waypoints, placeholders.
Well, what would Lord of the Rings be like if we had fast travel? It's like, oh, goodness, this open world game is a lot easier.
And eventually we have the escape from the Nazgul at Bree, and they meet Strider and learn that he's Aragorn. And they get to Elrond's home for the council.
Yeah.
And here it's interesting. We get to see a different depiction of Elrond than we saw from Rankin-Bass.
Yeah.
And this depiction of Elrond, I don't know, he's more like fitness model Elrond.
Yes.
He's this tall, chiseled guy with black hair. He's not this ethereal being from a different species of person the way the Elrond in the Rankin-Bass version was. There's no halo of stars dancing around his head, for example.
I would half expect this version of Elrond to put on arm and leg warmers and start dancercising just to keep his just to keep his physique. It feels like just odd in that way. I will say, especially once we're getting into the council and you get all these other characters in the room, I wouldn't say the voice acting is off. I would say everyone is giving a serious performance. They don't always sound like they were told the same direction onto the type of seriousness or the exact scene, but everyone is definitely giving it some kind of their all, and I appreciate that. And I gotta say, their Aragorn is excellent. John Hurt as Aragorn is wonderful.
Yes,
he puts in effort. He is taking a character who is warping just as much as everyone else, but he still does come across menacing every time he has to be, in a good way.
And yeah, I think that so much of the director's attention was on the animation that there wasn't very much left over for directing the performances and the actors. And also, even with a feature of this prominence, voiceover work for an animated feature, it wasn't considered as important an art form or as fully developed an art form as it was, you know, a generation later. So maybe it was considered that, yeah, as long as they're hitting the lines right and the timing is right, we have animation to worry about. Let's not worry about those performances.
Yeah.
But that's where, as you say, an actor with the talent and experience of a John Hurt rises above so much else that we see, that we hear.
It's the thing that can make weirdly awkward-looking Frodo sound blasé, but like he's taking everything seriously when talking about the end of the world. But it turns weird morphing, that's a lot of cross-hatching, Aragorn into, oh goodness, you have multiple knives, more than I think you have, and you will use all of those knives if you have to, and you don't want to, but you know how to use all of those knives. Got it.
And you know, I forgot, because I had mentioned it before with the Nazgul, but leading up to the meeting at Elrond's place, we do get the fight at the Weathertop with the Nazgul, where the Nazgul attack our camp of Aragorn and the hobbits, and Frodo submits to the compulsion of the ring and puts it on to try to hide, and it puts him into the Nazgul's dimension for a while. The visuals in that are great. I love the way the Nazgul look creepy and alien and mystical, and the way the world Frodo finds himself in looks that way. And we see more of that with the standoff at the ford just before Elrond's place, and the Nazgul's attempt to capture Frodo there.
And this one
loses so much because of the way they didn't save that technique for this kind of scene.
When this wants to do the creepy, it can do creepy.
Wow. Oh yeah, it does.
And there are some of these moments. It's them hiding under a root when things are looking over them is in this. It's wonderful. The fight in the dark with the light, they do some wonderful environmental stuff during that Nazgul fight. The feeling of this river being this clear dividing line in the visuals from one scene to another, all the world building, all the design aesthetics are really strong. It's like you want to see those used more and elsewhere.
Right.
Wait a minute. Wait multiple minutes. I'll talk about that in a bit.
Oh, okay. So we get the Council of Elrond, and they talk a little bit more about the history of the ring and what has to be done with it, and there's the fight, and we see Boromir is wanting to use the ring because it's the most powerful weapon, and Boromir's a Viking, apparently.
Yeah, Boromir is just straight up a Viking.
A Viking with no pants. And that starts off the journey of the Fellowship as they begin their quest to destroy the ring. And it leads us to Moria. What do you think of the depiction of Moria? You mentioned the Balrog, but what about Moria itself and getting in?
Oh, Moria is just kind of odd. A lot of the Moria scenes don't line up. Like, and I mean that in, like, a physical way. I mean the path the characters walk and the path drawn doesn't always line up. They clip corners.
I remembered this movie rather fondly. I'm not sure I saw this. I don't know that I've seen this movie since I saw it the week it opened in 1978.
Okay.
And my memories were kind of fond, and watching it again, I realized my fond memories were how cool the Nazgul looked, and some specific scenes that were these wonderful little animated illustrations of scenes that I liked in the books.
Okay.
So them being outside the back door to Moria and trying to get in. And
I do love the frustration they animate everyone with of just like, we're sitting here at this door. Why? And you just get crazy wild hands Gandalf, like trying to get the motion sensor to read him.
Yeah, why can't I get into this grocery store?
Exactly.
Oh, and we've talked about other members of the Fellowship. We haven't talked about Legolas.
Oh, no.
I'm sorry, Ian, we have to talk about Legolas.
Why?
I don't know what they were going for with the physiognomy of Legolas. The way they portray his face, it's like he's got to be thin and blonde, but we want him to be different, so let's maybe make him a little bit Asian, but no, can't be too Asian.
They unfortunately kind of blank his face and make his eyes a little off. It reminded me way too much of the way Stargate SG-1 depicted little gray aliens. With the oval eyes and the heads, it's like, and the lankiness, and then this, hi, I'm here, I'm talking to you. It's like, why?
And I don't know what the prompt would be. This is trendy right now, I know, but I don't know what the prompt would be, but he looks like his face was drawn by one of the AI image generators.
Yes!
It's recognizably human. I can kind of understand that there was some idea behind this, but it's just so weird. I don't understand what course of thought decisions would have led a human animator to design a character's face in this way. It's just so weird.
Oh my goodness, I figured it out. I figured something out there just now. The way his eyes are weirdly, highlighted, the way his mouth is a little off in terms of size, he looks like a stretched out Inkling from Splatoon.
Oh my goodness, you're right.
He's got, it's like take an Inkling and then stretch it to human proportions a little, and it creates Legolas from this move.
He's an elf now, he's himself now.
Yes! Oh my goodness.
So they get into Moria eventually, but I just love the way that scene was depicted. And they get into Moria, and there's some pretty cool scenes in Moria as they are dealing with the what they find there and finding out what happened to Gimli's kinsman. Gimli, I don't know how, Gimli's like the biggest dwarf. He is almost as tall as Aragorn.
Yeah.
And then the orcs. And the orcs also, they are like, they got a whole bunch of action stunt people to dress in weird clothes and masks. And then they just shot them and tinted them. And that's their animation.
Yeah, you ever taken a photograph of a group of your friends, but you've found the settings on the camera not to get rid of red eye, but to accentuate it and
yes.
Turn it up?
I like the creepy red eyes.
They do great creepy red eyes. And it's weird because the same way in old Scooby-Doo, you can tell what's going to move because it's a different shade than the background. It's like half of Moria, like the tomb that they look at, is heavy detailed work, and then the doors that they have to defend that'll swing around are these lighter colored things at this odd angle to the rest of the room, which makes the entire thing look slanted one way or the other. And so it's like, I know that the doors are going to be changed, but you're going to use the same backplate for the rest of the place you're in. It's like, ooh, I can feel that one. But the backplate, that room with the tomb is wonderful looking. It's once again great environmental and design work.
Yes.
It's just the moment it moves, it's weird.
And then while they're fleeing, we get to see the Balrog that you described earlier. And that would have been cool if the orcs that we had just seen didn't look creepier and weirder and more magical because of the techniques used.
Yeah. It's like, and they could have done things. They could have messed with scale. They could have animated them at the same time instead of two different passes of animation.
And during that whole flight, we get all these cuts back and forth for different angles. And sometimes the hobbits are thinly rotoscoped footage. Sometimes they're fully rendered, fully realized drawn animation.
Sometimes, it's very disorienting. Sometimes everyone is in a perfect line with a nice perspective they're moving into. Sometimes half of them seem to have just stepped off of what should be an edge of a cliff onto the path because something was misaligned. It's like, each shot was slightly done by a different pair or different. It's like three guys were given each shot, and not all trios were as good as the other.
And shortly after they escape from Moria, they get to Lothlorien and meet Galadriel and the rest of the elves. And
very Don Bluthy.
Yeah, very. Galadriel is very cute, not powerful. As you, I think you mentioned before, when she's talking about the calamity facing the world, she's kind of laughing it off like a Disney princess. They give her the speech about what would happen if she took the ring from Frodo as he offered. And it's, oh, isn't that a funny idea? All would love me in despair.
All would love me in despair. Like, comment, and subscribe is kind of her attitude and style to it. It rang so VTuber to me. It was like one of these people with an animated character. They've got it mapped. They can move around and they're just chatting. They're just talking with chat right now.
So is Galadriel's mirror just like a browser source in OBS? Or is that some other input?
Yeah, I don't know. It's got the gamer RGB going on.
In general, it's another example of how they just go from one set piece to another so quickly. It's like a collection of illustrations of the books, as opposed to being an adaptation of the story to tell the story.
This is an animated picture book, not an animated book in that sense. It is jumping from spread to spread. And it will skip over sections that it didn't draw.
I guess they devote the right amount of time to the journey down the Anduin River and the fight with the orcs that splits up the Fellowship. That's done pretty well. Again, some weirdness with the techniques used. But I like the way they depict Boromir's betrayal and redemption. All of that's done pretty well, and I do think we get some decent performances in that scene.
It does feel like they got a little more cohesive as they went along. Yes. Yeah, like the middle is the most unified and visually cohesive part of the entire movie.
Yeah, you can definitely accuse the story, the original story, of slowing down tremendously for a while after the Fellowship breaks up and we have Frodo and Sam going off through the horrible lands towards Mordor. And we have Gandalf coming back after he was believed to be killed, or after he was killed by the Balrog, and they all go off to see Theoden in Rohan. Because the story slows down, it's almost as if the movie now has a pace at which it can work. Because I thought they did a pretty good job of depicting Frodo and Sam's journey and their encounter of Gollum. Pretty good depiction of Gollum.
Yeah, Gollum has two animation styles, and that's a close to the camera, fully rendered model. But then if he gets a little too far away, to use video game terms, they will go to a lower poly version, which for some reason just screamed Muppet Babies in terms of its outline and bright coloration to make sure you could find him. But that's pretty good. It's like they've got so much more space to play with dark and creepy backgrounds that they can use. And so it just, that part flows a lot better. There's a maximum of three characters. There's a lot more environmental storytelling. And they're able to just hit this is hard, this is painful, despair, and maybe not trust the creepy gray guy. Very well.
And I forgot about the other group that splits off from the Fellowship, Merry and Pippin. The way that they are used, or rather the way that they are not used in this movie, you kind of could have left them out. If you really needed to shorten this story and streamline it, you could have left Merry and Pippin out if you needed to, and have other characters and other events get you to the points in the story that you need to in their absence. Because the way they're portrayed here, it's like, they're taken by the orcs, they escape from the orcs, they hitch a ride with the tree, and that's the last you see of them.
Yeah.
You don't get a lot of conversation with Treebeard, although you get a pretty cool scene of them walking, you know, being carried by Treebeard. They don't serve the story, really, at any point, at least in this first half of The Lord of the Rings, as portrayed by Bakshi.
Yeah, no.
On the other hand, the way they deal with Theoden and the group getting to Rohan, I like that. But I'm sorry, what did you think of Treebeard and Merry and Pippin?
The Treebeard stuff kind of keeps the trippiness going, I think, but it is kind of less necessary. There's something about, like, whatever team was doing that was the one that would slide from scene to scene a bit more sometimes. But it almost works when you're dealing with living trees in a creepy way.
Yeah.
And that actually functioned. So it's like, I that was not bad. Definitely not necessary anymore with the how else you've used them. But yeah. Not bad.
The way it's depicted, I thought was pretty good. How little we got to see of Merry and Pippin and what they were up to, you almost would have been better off forgetting about them.
Yeah.
Maybe that's harsh, but again, if you really are trying to compress things as much as this movie seemed to need to do. But when we got to Rohan and Theoden and Wormtongue, I thought that was done pretty well. I like the depiction of Theoden and what had happened to Theoden here better than some others, because it was a psychological conflict. He had been persuaded. He was an old man who had been convinced that he was irrelevant. And Gandalf was there to let him know that he's not.
Yeah. And the same manic energy this Gandalf has had really comes in, especially with the condensed time frame, in a what are you doing? You absolute fool. Smack.
Yes.
This guy. Absolutely trying to betray you. Smack. There's yes. This kind of like, just, I'm here to fix stuff.
It's a resurgence of the rap Gandalf.
It is. Yeah, Gandalf has arrived and found you lacking.
And we get most of the rest of the movie is some cool battle scenes. We get some fights between...
Cool?
Well, yeah, I think so. Well, weird and cool.
Weird. The more people on screen, the weirder the animation gets. Entire groups of fighters swerve as a unit, absolutely irregardless to the ground.
Yeah, it is a little bit just...
Multiple men are standing next to each other having conversations on the walls, and they are in different animation styles.
And we see a battle between orcs and a bunch of the riders of Rohan. Theoden's son. And yeah, there it's kind of like, we've shot these two armies and we've tinted this one that color. We've tinted with red eyes. We've tinted this other army a different color. And there's almost this slow ritualistic battle formation between the two of them. It's interesting. It's strange. It does slow things down.
It's kind of RTS-like.
It's interesting to watch. Yes. But then we get the retreat to Helm's Deep and the battle there.
Yeah, there's some pretty cool shots in there, but there's some pretty skin-crawling animation moments.
Yeah, we were talking about the way, you know, you go from one animation style to another, and it's so disorienting. There are a couple of shots there where it's literally two characters standing next to each other, and one is a faintly tinted monochrome rotoscoped actor. And the other is a detailed, colored, hand-drawn character.
Yeah.
It's like just bizarre. Really, really, really bizarre.
It just is wild. I almost was grateful when they have to retreat from there and they fail, because then you wind up with a lot of still shots of everyone drawn, and I'm like, oh, hey, we failed so hard, we became a point-and-click adventure game. Where's my toolbar?
And if you want to have a scene where it's Frodo and the Nazgul, and Frodo is a fully drawn and painted and realized animation, and the Nazgul is weirdly tinted rotoscoping, sure, yeah, that's great. It's just two guys on the same side standing on a parapet looking down, and they look that weirdly different. It's like it should have a lot of meaning that it doesn't for the story.
There's also some moments there where, because people are just standing and kind of delivering a report about how the battle is going, there's something almost Letterkenny-like, where it's just like the two of them standing there and just commenting on something, and it's like shot reverse shot stuff for a moment.
Pitter-patter.
Exactly. I'm like, oh, wow.
And that's kind of where we're left.
Yeah.
We have the victory over the bad guys at Helm's Deep when Gandalf comes back with the rest of the Riders of Rohan to flank the orcs. And we've got Frodo and Sam with Gollum about to lead them into the staircase where they're going to encounter. I don't think even think that they mention Shelob, but that's where they're headed.
Gollum kind of like hints, oh, I've got a friend who will take care of them.
She'll take care of them.
She'll take care of them. But we never see Big Spider.
Nope. And yeah, that's kind of the halfway point. And there was a plan to make part two to finish the story, but that never happened.
That never happened. It didn't do quite as well as they'd hoped. It did pretty well, but it got bad reviews, which means they didn't get the second, from what I understand.
Yeah, and it's one of those, I don't know that it has aged well in terms of how well people regard it. But yeah, it didn't do well enough critically or financially to finance the second part. So it was kind of just an orphaned part one of a two-part story.
Yeah, it was originally supposed to be called Lord of the Rings Part One, but they got rid of Part One. Like, during production.
Now, was that because the studio, do you think that was because the studio looked at it and said, we're going to release this, but we don't think that we're going to be in for a second part, because it looks weird, and we don't think it's going to
play. I think that might have been.
That may be. Maybe they just didn't want to scare off audiences.
Yeah.
It's not like there hadn't already been some precedent for that.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a bigger precedent for calling the sequel Part 2 than for calling the first movie Part 1.
Yeah.
It was kind of new.
That's a bit of an issue.
And to me, they had a very difficult task, and that was to please the legions of Tolkien fans, who were a weird little niche, but they were a lot of us. But also to make a movie that was accessible and understandable and told a story that could be followed by people who had never read these books and really weren't familiar with them and just wanted to go to and see a good movie. And I don't know that they achieved either of those. They rushed through so much and they kind of assumed so much knowledge. I don't know that anybody who hadn't read The Lord of the Rings or wasn't familiar with the story would have known what to make of this movie.
Without that knowledge ahead of time, the disjointed elements would be even more disconcerting.
Yeah, you wouldn't know what was being skipped. You just, oh, now we're here. Where are we? And I think that skipping as much as they did, and some of the weird things like the disappointing portrayal of the Balrog, that would have disappointed the existing Tolkien fans who knew and loved the story and wanted to see it on a big screen.
This entire thing, without knowledge of the grandeur and the scope of it, would have felt more Ren Faire without anything else. It would have felt like you're going from stand to stand, themed thing to themed thing. Quality was shifting. There's a little, it feels cheesier. But there's so much good design. There's so much good design about how they depicted this world. So many pieces, colors, tones, artistic styles that,
I wonder if there's enough material here that it would be possible to make, it would be more than just a new cut of this movie, but if you could take some of this material, convert some of it into fully drawn and painted and fully rendered cell animation to highlight the stuff that was done with the weird and creepy, interesting rotoscoping and insertion of live action, and make a better version that maintains that distinction between the different styles meaning different things. I don't know if there's enough of the footage left. I don't know if there's enough footage even in the movie as it exists to work with. But it's an interesting idea. Could you salvage the really interesting and well-executed stuff in this movie to make something more coherent?
Yeah. I mean, we made jokes about AI generation, but I wonder if you could take a well-trained AI generation program and hand all of it these frames as storyboards and tell it to generate a consistent look for this shot and tell it to use that, like, use this as the baseline and then let something else polish it based on an entire library of other things.
Oh, that's an interesting idea. If there's a scene missing, feed it the scene from the books and feed it this animation as material and tell it, create a 4-minute scene for the movie.
feed it some of the best still frames of this, and then refeed it some of those rougher frames, those battles where two people are animated with completely different styles next to each other, and say, redraw this like that scene, like that other, those other frames we gave you, and redraw some of the scenes that already exist, even, but cohesive.
True. Although those, at least you could, human animators could do that. They could take that scene and say, yeah, make both of these guys hand drawn cell animation.
They absolutely
could. But, you know, maybe for speed and economic reasons, having AI do some of this work makes a lot of sense.
Oh, yeah. AI filling in, human animators guiding it, and taking certain specific scenes to be able to build that baseline themselves.
Yeah, because certainly nobody's going to finance this dream of hiring a whole bunch of animators to do this. But, I don't know, having some...
small team and a couple of tools.
Some rogue fans feeding this stuff into the right AIs.
Oh, yeah.
Be interesting what they come up with.
Yeah, well, we're leading into our final questions.
I guess so. Well, first question, screen or no screen?
Oh, scream or no scream? Don't mind if I do. As fun as Lord of the Rings is, this was too trippy. This was too weird. I'm going to say no screen because it was weird and just a little too much for me. I felt like I'd had multiple drinks by the end. My vision was swimming.
Well, I mean, if you are a fan of animation and of animation history, you kind of have to see this because it is a milestone. But putting that aside, if you just want to see a good movie, I can't say screen this.
Yeah, it's like there's reasons to, but not as film.
I would absolutely take a page out of your book for this movie and say, put this on with the sound down and put on a Black Sabbath record, and you've got some really weird, cool party background. Because it is so strange and disorienting and inconsistent and these weird juxtapositions.
While all your players for the D&D campaign are arriving, guess what's on the TV on mute? It's this.
You've got to have some weird soundtrack on top of it, though.
Yes.
So yeah, just in terms of just sitting down to watch a movie, it pains me to say this because I had been so looking forward to seeing this again because I get to show it to you. I can't recommend that anybody else take the time to screen this as a movie.
Yeah.
So, again, this is the next question is a weird one for this. Revive, reboot, or rest in peace?
Well, we got to do what we always do, which is acknowledge both that this is already an adaptation. So that means there's other versions of it out there. And that's where I've got to say, it's almost like I was hoping someone would have taken this as a major inspiration and pulled as much design elements as they could and redone it. Oh, wait, this was a huge influence on the Peter Jackson films. Everything from the way the cloaks are designed to the way towns are shown to various different moments are all referencing this movie, which is wild to me. This movie did baseline work on how Lord of the Rings would be depicted in the thing that brought Lord of the Rings to an entire new swath of people that had never touched it before.
Sometimes very, very clearly and literally.
Literally shot for shot moments.
The one thing that happens on the way to Bree, which is that they have to hide from a Black Rider.
It is a shot for shot remake moment.
It's composed, it's framed, it's exactly the... There are more cuts in the Peter Jackson version to enhance the tension, but in terms of the overall composition, The frames from this, the cells from this, might as well have been a storyboard.
And for me, I knew of Lord of the Rings beforehand, and I tried to read them before and had trouble, but I didn't actually get to experience the full story until the movies. And
the Peter
Jackson movies let me then go back in and go through and read some of, and it was able to help me get into the Lord of the Rings. I knew of it early compared to some people that I'd known. It was this... like, oh, my folks have talked about that. Oh, I've never heard of it. Kind of discussion. But it did help me actually experience the story for the first time. I am grateful to this animated version because the thing that helped me enjoy these wouldn't exist without it.
Oh, I like that. Kind of acknowledging this as the heritage.
Exactly. So in some ways, that's already a reboot for me.
Okay.
That's how I'm defining it. The Peter Jackson ones fulfill the idea of reboot. It is doing this in the way this did it better. It's doing this depiction and this form of how to show the world of Middle Earth, but it's doing it with a grander and more cohesive look because it's taking its inspiration and its styling from the way this one did it.
Yeah, I mean, if you wanted a revival, I guess revival, unless you're going to get Ralph Bakshi's The Silmarillion.
Oh, no, yes.
Which might work better.
That actually might work way better.
But the obvious revival would just be, let's make the second part that Bakshi had wanted to make. And I can't imagine that happening. I don't know that I'd like it, but you know, maybe it could happen with the kind of AI work that you were just talking about a few minutes ago.
I actually think it does exist. Because I get to pull a weird twist on you.
Yeah.
I'm going to cite what I think is the revival, but it takes the weirdest things from it. The same time that the Lord of the Rings movies were coming out, a large number of Flash animators were acting in the biggest capacity they had online. It was a heyday for them. And the number of weird comedy Flash animations about Lord of the Rings that I feel also take something from this, but take the weirdness of the way this animates it and the way it depicts the Lord of the Rings in an almost silly way because of how the animation doesn't fit the seriousness. I feel like the other things are revival by taking it in a whole new direction. I'm literally saying that this thing atomically split into both the serious movies and the silly online gags.
I had no idea that
some of
Flash Animation Lord of the Rings existed.
Flash Animation Lord of the Rings was an entire subcategory. Some of them are horribly inappropriate and crass, I'll warn you, but it's a whole subset of things with wild jokes and things in there.
Well, I'm now imagining Coach Z as Gollum and Strong Sad as Elrond.
It's that kind of thing. It's brilliantly weird. I will find some of them and show them to you.
You must destroy the ring for the purple.
Yes! This is the sort of thing I'm talking about. So there's, like, animated Lord of the Rings has its own other side existence,
okay,
thanks to this.
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't think we're ever going to get a revival of the Ralph Bakshi Lord of the Rings.
No.
Except to the extent that we did through this Flash animation. And, yeah, I agree with you as far as reboot goes. Yes, I would like a reboot. Thank you very much. We've had it. I don't know that I need another depiction, but you're right. This, you could very much see Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings as, like, any new adaptation of the same source material that is de facto a reboot, but it's a reboot that acknowledges the debt that it has to this Ralph Bakshi version. So I think that's a good way to look at this, is that it set the stage for a much better, fuller, completer, more realized adaptation that we got a couple of decades later.
Oh yeah.
So maybe by showing you this, I've helped you appreciate some of where the Peter Jackson versions came from.
Absolutely. I am very happy that we watched this. I'm delighted we watched this and The Hobbit from our previous episode. This was a great time. It was a wild trip. But it was actually very nice to be able to see how this thing that I know only when it hit its, like, it hit a certain media burst at a time, and that's how I know it, and seeing how it was translated in between its initial bursts and its later popularity, and this, seeing those other points on the path was really good, and I really appreciated it, so thank you.
Now, they were really counting on making a sequel to this, to the point where the producers of this were trying to stop that Rankin-Bass version of Return of the King.
What?
Because they thought it was going to interfere with the planned sequel to Ralph Bakshi's Lord of the Rings. But instead, what happened was, I think a lot of people, they got to see this movie, and then they watched the Rankin-Bass musical version of Return of the King to get some resolution.
Oh my.
So imagine if your only knowledge of the Lord of the Rings is this, plus a Rankin-Bass version of the final act.
Ugh. That's got to be weird.
So one of these days, I might have to find and show you that Return of the King.
I'm ready for it.
But it'll be a while before that, I think.
Yeah.
But we really appreciate everybody listening and downloading this episode. It was fun to share this with Ian. It's fun to share this with all of you.
Absolutely. And in the meantime, Dad, where can they find you online?
You can find me most places as By Matthew Porter. You can go to bymatthewporter.com. You can find me on Twitter as By Matthew Porter. You can also find me on YouTube as By Matthew Porter. And by the way, if you go there, you can hear me ramble about more movies, because I'm keeping a Draft House diary where I review every visit I make to an Alamo Draft House cinema using my shiny new Alamo season pass. And Ian, where can people find you?
I can be found on Twitter as Item Crafting, on Twitch as Item Crafting Live, as Item Crafting on YouTube, and at itemcrafting.com.
And you can find the podcast at immproject.com or on Twitter as immpcast. And at that website, immproject.com, you'll find links to all of our past episodes, as well as a link to our Patreon. Thank you very much for supporting us there. A link to our shop if you like coffee mugs and t-shirts and other fun things. So they make great gifts. And a link to our YouTube and essentially anything else we're doing online. So again, thank you for downloading. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next.
Dad?
What?
Why do I hear the beating of drums and the sound of sleigh bells?
Because we're moving into the holiday season with a whole new holiday theme.
Oh, boy.
So we'll see you all in 2 weeks.
In the meantime, go find something new to watch.